Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome to today's webinar, Root Cause Analysis and Systemic Corrective Action. My name is Shannon Craddock. I'm the Programs and Accreditations Manager here at PJR, and I welcome you to today's webinar. I know your time is very valuable, so I hope you find today's content informative and entertaining. All participants have been muted to ensure sound quality. If you have any questions, please type them into the question or chat feature of GoToWebinar. And at the end of the prepared content, I'll answer as many questions as possible. One of the most common questions we get is if folks can access copies of these slides or a recording of today's webinar. And I'm pleased to inform you that yes, that's possible. About 24 to 48 hours after today's broadcast, you'll be able to download a copy of the slides as well as a recording of the webinar from our website, and that's www.pjr.com. Just click on previously recorded webinars. In that same area, you'll be able to look at upcoming webinars. We've got a lot of free and exciting content prepared for you. So without further ado, let's start talking about root cause analysis and systemic corrective action. So first of all, let's talk about why we're doing this, why today's topic. Then we'll spend some time talking about the audit finding itself, and how it's so important to have a well-written audit finding to set the stage for good problem solving. We'll then talk about the parts of a corrective action response, including actions taken to correct the issue. These are containment actions or corrections. We'll talk about root cause analysis, and while I'll mention several different techniques, we're just going to focus on the why technique, the 5-why technique. Then we'll talk about corrective actions, which are actions taken to prevent recurrence. And we'll talk about preventive actions, which are actions taken to prevent occurrence of a finding to begin with. And then we'll talk about what makes up a good corrective action verification activity. So why this topic? This is actually one of our most popular webinars, and for good reason. It's really important. We really want your organization to improve, and there should be a strong correlation between how you do on a third-party audit and your overall quality record with your customers. So if through our audits we can drive improvement of your system, you should see improvement in your on-time, on-quality performance to your customers. Now, contrary to popular belief, the purpose of a management systems audit isn't to talk your auditor out of writing nonconformities. It's for you to accept the nonconformities that are valid, and we'll talk about what a valid nonconformity is versus one that isn't, and take sound corrective action for each and every valid nonconformity. And if you're taking good corrective action, that means you're preventing recurrence. And when we're preventing recurrence of issues, that's when we get to see the stronger correlation. So let's set the stage. Let's talk about a well-written audit finding. A well-written nonconformity needs to have three distinct parts: a statement of nonconformity, objective evidence to support that statement, and then a clear citation of the requirement that's not being met, whether it's from ISO 9001, ISO 14001, maybe the auditee's own management system, a customer requirement, a piece of legislation, the requirement needs to be clearly cited. So audit findings that don't have these three parts shouldn't be written by PGR auditors and shouldn't be accepted by our clients either. In fact, I'm here to tell you today that you're empowered to reject findings that don't contain these three parts back to your lead auditor and ask that they be rewritten. From time to time, our auditors may write opportunities for improvement. And if they do, they should exist only as statements or recommendations. There should not be a citation of a requirement that isn't being fulfilled, because if a requirement was not being fulfilled, it should be written as a non-conformity. So let's talk about some common pitfalls with a statement of non-conformity. And by far the one we see most often is that the non-conformity that's recorded isn't the true problem, but it's a symptom of the problem. So it's very important that the problem is expressed as an issue with the system. If the problem isn't expressed if the problem is expressed in terms of an individual or a very specific incident, it's at the symptom stage, and we want to avoid this. And I see third-party auditors make this mistake, unfortunately. But also when I'm doing my own auditing, I see that internal auditors often make this mistake. So when problem solving is happening and we're answering nonconformities, we want to get to the true problem, i.e. the systemic issue, or the problem solving efforts won't be effective. So fixing symptoms will not stop the issue from recurring. So let's take a moment and reflect on what's happening today. In the United States, we've got an outbreak of RSV, especially in children, in the flu, in the common cold, and in COVID. So if you have an infection, like a strep throat infection, you can take something to alleviate your symptoms. You can take Tylenol to bring your fever down. You can take an Aleve to help with muscle aches and pains, or maybe a sore throat. But all the Tylenol, all the Aleve in the world will not stop or kill a strep throat infection. So fixing symptoms doesn't stop the issue from recurring. Just like taking a leave isn't going to kill the strep throat bacteria. We've got to remember that. More on that later. Another common pitfall with nonconformity is that it should stand the test of time. So your organization should be able to look at a nonconformity written 10 years ago and understand exactly what the problem was. It shouldn't just be easily understandable because it's a recent incident or something that happened last week and everybody knows, oh yeah, that's what they meant. That was that thing that happened last week. It doesn't work. It needs to contain very specific traceable evidence to assist in understanding. Okay, so let's illustrate these points, these common nonconformity pitfalls with some examples. So here's a poorly written finding. There was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954, indicating confidence to run that job. This illustrates the first pitfall that I discussed. This is a symptom and not the true systemic issue. It's not the problem. We're confusing objective evidence with a statement of nonconformity. Here's a better way to write this. The system. In fact, we're using that word system right in the statement itself. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Now, here's the clear objective evidence to support that statement. No training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954. And then we have a clear citation of the requirement not being met. In this case, 9001-2015-72D, And you'll note here that we're citing as far out as we can to the subclause and then the suffix, letter D. So a well-written nonconformity would be the system for recording employee training and competences and completely effective. Here we're focusing on the systemic issue. And again, that word system is right in the statement of nonconformity. We're not focusing on one symptom of the problem. We're not just focusing on that first shift operator running job 9954. Okay, example number two. The quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Again, we're focusing on a specific person, a very specific incident. This means that the statement of nonconformity is at the symptom level, not at the process level. Again, we're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. A better way to write this: the document control system is not completely effective. And then the objective evidence to assist in understanding of a quality auditor in the blue cell using an uncontrolled form to record the results of the first inspection. And a citation of the requirement, this time in 9001:2015, 7531A. And again, we're taking that as far out as possible. We're not just saying section 7. Or 7.5, all the way out to the letter suffix. So a better way to write this: the document control system is not completely effective. Here, again, we're using that word system right in the nonconformity statement, focusing on the systemic issue, not focusing on a specific person, that quality auditor in the blue cell, or a certain incident, the fact that they were using the wrong form. So when you review a statement of nonconformity written by one of your internal auditors or a PJR auditor, or maybe even your customers, you want to make sure that they're distinguishing between the real issue and symptoms of the problem. And you have a final statement of nonconformity focusing on the systemic issue or at the process level. And then, are there clear data to assist in understanding? Objective evidence, now that's at the symptom level. It's going to reflect a certain person or incident. And then a very detailed citation of the requirement not being met. Now, PJR has an internal document. It's our PJR Advisory 3 that requires all auditors to document any nonconformity in the way I just described. We also require all auditors to document any non-fulfillment of a requirement as such. So if they truly have a nonconformity, they shouldn't be telling you, oh, just fix it. Just, I know you'll take care of it. It's inexcusable for them to do that. There's really no benefit for you other than you get to tell your manager you got fewer NCRs, but you're not really addressing the root cause of the issue and preventing recurrence. You're just addressing the symptoms of the problem. And this really contributes to the diminishment of the integrity of accredited management system certification. And we're not going to see that correlation between audit results and improvement of your system, which is going to lead to a better on-time, on-quality record. So it is my expectation that all nonconformities written by PJR auditors need to be documented as I just described. And if they fail to do so, you're empowered to reject these at the closing meeting and ask them to rewrite them in the way I just described. Okay, so let's move on now. We've got a well-written nonconformity. We're convening our multidisciplinary problem-solving team. Folks from all disciplines are invited to attend. This is not just the job of the management representative sitting in front of their computer 48 hours before the corrective actions are due. It should be a team effort to do the problem solving. Typically, we start with actions taken to correct. And these are called containment actions or corrections. And they're actions that are very specific to the symptom or incident. They're incident-specific actions. They're very important, and you want to take them as soon as possible to stop the symptoms from persisting. So just like you have a strep throat infection, before you get to the doctor and they prescribe an antibiotic to treat the strep throat infection, you typically take something to alleviate your symptoms, to bring down your fever, to just make you feel more comfortable. Similarly, you'll want to take some type of correction to stop the symptoms of the problem in your management system. So these actions typically take two forms. So something along the lines of, we calibrated the gauge that was found to be uncalibrated, or we controlled a form that was out of control or past its revision level, or adding a layer of inspection to catch any further recurrence of the issue. But remember, inspection adds cost to the system. It's not adding value. And we're going to learn that once a corrective action is fully implemented, then costly added inspections can be removed from the system. The containment actions or corrections you take need to be very specific. So to follow up on the issues that we've been following since the beginning of today's webinar, an example of a correction for that first finding would be the training matrix for the first shift operator running jobs 9954 was updated to reflect his competency to run the job unsupervised. Or all copies of the uncontrolled form the quality auditor in the blue cell was using were destroyed. Corrections also need to include an extent analysis. So let's spend a few minutes talking about what an extent analysis or look across is. So our third party auditor, the PJR auditor, may find one instance. They may find one gauge that's past due for calibration, or one training record that's not updated, or one purchase order that didn't have the appropriate level of approval. But how many more are there? In other words, what is the depth and breadth of the problem? So the PJR auditor has uncovered one or more examples of a non-conforming situation. One gauge out of calibration, a document that isn't controlled, a training record not updated. So a properly executed and well-written extent analysis would read something like this. We verified the two gauges found by the PJR auditor, 2458 and 1354. Both were conforming. Our extent analysis included the 213 other gauges in our facility. Only one was found to be out of calibration. It was calibrated and returned to service. No product was measured with this gauge since it was last in a known state of calibration. This is a really well done look across or extent analysis. We know that the PJR auditor found two gauges out of calibration, 2458 and 1354. The company verified those gauges and said, okay, even though they were past due for calibration, they were in a conforming state. We looked at every other gauge, and there's 213 of them in our facility. Only one, and we know which one it is by its identifier, was found to be out of calibration. So they calibrated it and returned it to service. And then they went and looked and to see if that gauge had been used ever since it was last in a known state of calibration, which would have been its last calibration date. Fortunately, it was not, so they didn't have to do any product recalls. If you use the PJR nonconformity report when replying to nonconformities written during PJR audits, it has been modified to include a blank for extent analysis. Now, you don't have to use the PJR form, but you want to make sure that your own form has the same blanks as the PJR form so that your responses don't get rejected. Okay, so we've talked about how to write a good nonconformity to set the problem-solving team up for success. We've talked about corrections. Now let's move to root cause. So a common pitfall, and I would say if a nonconformity gets rejected for root cause, it's for this reason, is that the root cause restates the incident itself. This isn't acceptable. So what do I mean by this? Well, let's take a look at the examples we've been following through today's webinar. As a root cause, the organization may say, well, our organization just failed to update the training matrix for the operator running job 9954. Well, duh, we told you that when we wrote the finding. Clearly the matrix wasn't updated. You need to tell us why that didn't happen. We already know you failed to update it. Or the quality auditor in the blue cell didn't use the correct form to record the results of first critical inspection. Again, genius, we already told you that. We know that. We wrote that in the objective evidence. You need to tell us why in your root cause analysis. And these two responses here, this bullet point and this bullet point, aren't telling us that. Another pitfall is that some cars restate the containment action for the root cause. And while not as common, this is also not acceptable. Okay, so if you've stopped paying attention and you've wandered away to check your email or your Instagram, this is the single most important slide in today's webinar. A good root cause analysis answers the question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? A good root cause analysis answers the question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? Again, the focus is on the system, not the incident. Now, it's possible that some problems may have multiple root causes. Some problems may have several possible root causes. If the root cause cannot be discovered, we have to take corrective action on all of the possible root causes. If the root cause has been found, you should be able to turn the problem on and off like a light switch. If you can't turn the problem on and off at will, then the root cause has probably not been found. So let me illustrate this with an example. I used to work in the automotive industry, and I worked in a facility that did plastic injection molding, and we had a dual cavity tool that made a part that went on GM vehicles. So this tool was dual cavity, and it made a left hand and a right hand part at the same time. The issue is that we were mixing left hand parts in right hand boxes and vice versa. So this created a big issue at GM. It shut down lines. We were in some serious trouble. We had our own containment people. We were paying lots of money for a third-party containment service to be on-site at our facility, on time at the General Motors assembly plant to sort through these issues. We convened a problem-solving team, and we changed the configuration of the manufacturing cell so that the left-hand pack-out box was on the left-hand side of the operator's body and the right-hand pack-out box was on the right-hand side of the operator's body. Before, it wasn't configured that way due to space constraints. And we patted ourselves on the back, spent thousands of dollars moving not only the manufacturing press in question, but the presses on either side of it to make room for the pack-out boxes. And while the problem improved, we were still mixing left-hand parts and right-hand boxes and vice versa. So we weren't able to turn the problem off just like a light switch. Our corrective action helped, and maybe it dimmed the problem, but we couldn't turn it off. So we knew we did not have the true root cause. So again, we convened another problem-solving team, and this time we invited a material handler from the third shift. And he said, you know, if it was impossible, to put a left-hand part in a right-hand packout box and vice versa. We wouldn't have this issue. So we worked with the packaging engineer. We developed new packaging. We got the packaging approved by General Motors. And sure enough, we were able to turn the problem off like a light switch. And it did not return when we were using these new packout boxes. And in fact, in a controlled environment, we reintroduced the old packaging. And with some dummy runs, we proved that the problem turned back on in a limited way, but it did turn back on. So we knew we had the true root cause. Now, there are a lot of different techniques for root cause analysis, and you can use whatever works for your organization. Is this not fishbone or Ishikawa diagram, the 5-Y technique? But sometimes I think you can get there in fewer whys. That's what we'll talk about today. So in the why technique, you're asking why over and over again until you feel like you get to the true root cause. Now remember, who's asking why? It's not just the management representative sitting in front of his or her computer. It's a multidisciplinary team of people sitting around a real or virtual conference table asking these questions over and over again. So we had our finding. The system for recording employee training and competence isn't completely effective. There was no training matrix for the first shift operator. Running job 9954 indicating competence to run that job. So why wasn't there a training matrix? Well, the first shift supervisor failed to update the training matrix as required by the first of the month. Well, why did they fail to do this? Why did they fail to do this? Well, before the end of the previous month, the HR manager would email the training matrix template to all the supervisors. But this didn't happen that month. Well, why didn't it happen? Well, the HR manager left the company before the end of the month and her supervisor didn't email the template. Well, why didn't her supervisor email the template? You'll note I'm asking why over and over again. The procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all the supervisors. So you may ask yourself, I'll go back to that slide. Well, why didn't the procedure for training include that requirement? Knowing you've gone far enough sometimes can be a little challenging, but having a multidisciplinary team to say, I think we've got it, is much better than one person saying, yep, I think I've gone far enough in this analysis. And if any of you are parents, you know when your kids ask why over and over again, can I have a candy bar before dinner? No. Well, why? Well, you can't, because then it'll spoil your appetite for dinner. And I've worked hard creating a healthy and nutritious meal. Well, why? And they ask why over and over again. When you get to the point where you say, because I'm the mom and I said so, with this analysis. Well, the procedure we're training, it just didn't include the requirement. You know you've gone far enough. All right, let's look at our second example. The document control system is not completely effective. The quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. First, why? Why were they using the uncontrolled form? Well, controlled hard copies of the form had been used in the blue cell, so the quality auditor resorted to an uncontrolled form. Well, why did they do that? Well, this person was not aware that when no hard copies of a particular form were available, the latest version of all forms could be accessed through the company's database. Well, why didn't they have this knowledge? Well, the quality auditor in the blue cell was not even given a username and password to access the database. Well, why weren't they? HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a system username and password. So this multidisciplinary problem-solving team felt they had gotten there in 4 whys. Okay. So some things we won't accept for root cause. And again, a really important slide. Oversight, we see oversight a lot. We misunderstood the requirement. Now, admittedly, I do have some tolerance for this on a first audit. So on your initial audit, you may not have understood the intent of a requirement. And in your third party audit, the way the auditor asks the questions or explains the requirement to you makes it clear. But we won't accept we misunderstood the requirement on surveillance audit 38. I forgot another ISO 9000 blunder. We had a client that wrote that for every single root cause. Our consultant messed up. Again, your consultant has nothing to do with maintaining your management system and making it a living, breathing thing in your organization, or human error. We get human error a lot, not possible. Something in the system allows humans to fail. Fix the systemic issue. All right, let's move on to corrective actions. They should address the root cause. They therefore should answer that very important question: what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? Many organizations give containment actions or corrections instead of corrective actions, and this isn't acceptable. So we see a lot of corrections repeated as the corrective action. Not only should they address the root cause or the systemic issue, but they need to be irreversible, and they need to involve a change in the system. So keep in mind that retraining is generally not a system change, nor are corrections. Also in the automotive industry, corrective action should prompt changes to the design and process FEMA, the control plan, and may require a PPAP. There needs to be at least one corrective action for each root cause that was identified. And subsequent data should show that the problem has 100% disappeared. So we talked about packing left-hand parts into right-hand boxes. Reconfiguring the pack-out boxes within the manufacturing cell didn't make the problem 100% disappear. So we knew we didn't have the true root cause. Redesigning and reconfiguring the pack-out boxes did do that. So we knew we had the true root cause because we turned the problem off like a light switch and made it 100% disappear. So let's take a look at the examples we've been following through. Nonconformity system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. The company's corrective action reads as follows. Section 4.6, the procedure for training, was updated to include a requirement for the HR manager to email the training matrix template to all supervisors before the end of every month. The new HR manager was trained on this, and she added an automatic reminder to her Outlook to perform this task. Does this corrective action address the root cause? Well, let's go back and see. The root cause is that the procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all supervisors. And now it does. The procedure has been revised. There's a training component to our corrective action, but it's not the only component to our corrective action. And there's an addition of a reminder in Microsoft Outlook. Let's take a look at our second example. The document control system is not completely effective. Corrective action, the new hire work instruction was revised to include a requirement to grant new hires a username and password for the database is appropriate, and HR personnel were trained on this change. Well, what about this corrective action? Does it address the root cause? Here's our root cause. HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a system username and password. And now the new hire work instruction was revised to include a requirement to grant new hires a username and password. And there's also a training component, but the training is not the sole component to this corrective action. There's also a system change in the new hire work instruction. It's also a good idea that when training is included as part of the corrective action response, you're going to talk about the technique that you use to verify training effectiveness. Are you going to give an exam, for example? That always ensures that the training was effective. Because let's face it, initially, before the problem existed, you probably did some training. How are you going to ensure that the retraining component of your corrective action response is more effective this time? All right, let's briefly talk about preventive actions. Preventive actions answer one of two questions. What other systems exist that might have the same root cause present? Or what systems could I have had in place that would have prevented this from happening? So sometimes corrective action reports will put corrective actions for preventive actions. But remember, preventive actions address the future, not the past. So what could still happen, not what did happen. Preventive actions address the system, not the incident. Because remember, nothing's happened. There's no incident, there's no symptom. And they involve changing the system to prevent future problems. Preventive actions are only identified because of nonconformities. You need to have proactive processes within your organization with inputs from a lot of sources. Near miss reports, 5S programs, lean initiatives, employee feedback, employee suggestion boxes. And you need to have a way to consider all of these preventive action opportunities and figure out how to implement those best. It's all about managing risk. Finally, let's close out with the last component of problem solving, and that's verification. And this is a critical and often not performed step in the problem solving process. And a lot of times I see auditee versions of CAR forms that don't even have a spot or a blank or a prompt for good verification. So in a sound verification exercise, what do you need to do? You need to make sure that the correction or corrective or containment was taken. There's proper root cause analysis and you're able to turn the problem 100% off like a light switch. The corrective action that addresses the root cause has been implemented. And if you have any corrections that were the type that is a costly added layer of inspection, you've removed them if you had those. So in the example that I gave where we were putting left-hand parts in right-hand boxes and vice versa, I mentioned that we had our own employees sorting through boxes in our facility. And we had a third-party containment company sorting through boxes at the assembly plant. Once we knew we had the true root cause and turned the problem off like a light switch, we could stop paying for that. We moved that costly added layer of inspection. And if appropriate, opportunities for preventive action have been considered. Understand that corrective actions, while meant to be irreversible, may sometimes be reversible. So when you're changing a system, it means that how work is being performed is changing. Let's face it, change is difficult. Systems may return to where people feel comfortable. So you need to continue to verify actions even after you get positive results on the first verification. So sometimes you need to keep things open on your log for a while and verify them multiple times to make sure that corrective action is still working. The goal shouldn't be to click things off your log as quickly as possible. It's to get multiple green lights where you see that, yes, this continues to work 90 days after corrective action implementation, 6 months after corrective action implementation, a year, up to 18 months. I'd like to acknowledge that some of today's side content is provided by the IAOB. And I'll now open the floor to any questions or comments that you may have. Please feel free to type them into the question box in the GoToWebinar. Okay, folks, bear with me as I pull out some of these questions. So we don't email copies of the slides. Jonathan, you can download them from our website, www.pjr.com. Matt, a near miss report is something very common in a 45001 system where there might be an incident or accident or possible incident or accident, and a near miss report is completed. Okay, Willie is asking, how can we obtain a copy of our the NCR form? So if you've previously received a nonconformity from Perry Johnson, Willie, you can just look at the fields on that form. If you're pretty close to perfect and never have, you can call the office and ask for a copy of our audit report to be sent to you, and that has the template. Jose is asking, what techniques could be used to verify effectiveness of training? The best technique, Jose, is to administer some type of exam after the training to make sure people understood the material that was communicated. I also think it's a good idea for training to be interactive, so not just a talking head format. So let me illustrate by example. In that same automotive company that I spoke of, we kept getting nonconformities because our material handlers weren't recording the lot number of the material being used appropriately. They couldn't always distinguish what the lot number was because different manufacturers called it different things. So in our training exercise, we pulled a variety of tags off of material, some which called the lot number, and others that called it maybe a manufacturing date. And we asked them to record what they thought was the lot number, and then we did a group discussion after that exam. Wendy is asking, what's the impact of a major nonconformity? Major nonconformities are written typically when there's a breakdown in your system, multiple instances of a single incident or complete lack of implementation. With some management systems, it automatically leads to suspension. In other management systems, it doesn't, but most often a revisit is needed. Let me know if I'm not answering your question appropriately. Okay. Iman is asking, if we can't find the root cause, what can we do? You need to invite more people to your problem solving meeting, Iman. You need to get more input. Remember that there may be several possible root causes. You have to take corrective action on all of them, but likely that's what's happening. Jesse's asking if operator error is a sufficient root cause for supplier corrective actions. Jesse, I'm guessing that what you mean is you issue a SCAR to one of your suppliers and it comes back with operator error. if anything is sunk in from today's presentation, that's not an appropriate root cause. And I kick it back to your supplier to get them to identify the process issue that allowed operator error to occur. Maxine is asking, how does PGR handle recurring nonconformities? Maxine, I guess the context you're referring to is we've got an auditee that on surveillance one, they have a nonconformity, and then it's repeated on surveillance two. That typically means that the organization did a very poor job with problem solving initially on that first audit. And that's why those findings are repeating themselves in the second audit. So typically what we do is we'll elevate those nonconformities to majors, and we will write a second finding on corrective action, because obviously their corrective action isn't working. Otherwise, why were the findings repeated from one audit to next year's audit? Some PGR auditors have told me it's not acceptable to keep corrective action open as long as 3 or 6 months. What should I say to them? That's a question from Laura. I think there's a difference, Laura. You want to make sure that you're quickly solving a nonconformity and implementing those corrections, taking the leave, for example, to bring down the fever, and then implementing corrective action as quickly as you can. Getting the actions in place quickly is important, but you can keep it open and continue to monitor it for multiple months. That's very important. And that's it. That's an important distinction. You need to make sure you're clearly communicating to your auditor. Salima is asking, how is human negligence handled in the root cause process? So it appears you're trying to make a distinction between human error and human negligence. So we have somebody intentionally making mistakes to sabotage the system. And if you identify that, I would expect that action is taken relative to that employee in terms of rehabilitation or possible termination of their role. Wendy is asking, explain the difference between major and minor nonconformity as it relates to systemic failure. So I want to preface this by saying that different management system standards have different definitions for majors and minors. For example, the aerospace and automotive standards have very specific definitions as to what's classified as a major versus a minor. But I will speak in general terms for this presentation and its larger audience. Typically, a major is a systemic failure, a breakdown. There's more than one example of something happening. So a minor would be one gauge out of calibration, and not a gauge used in final inspection, whereas a major would be, this is the gauge used in final inspection, even if it's one or multiple gauges used are found out of calibration. Another example of a major nonconformity would be a repeat finding from last year that rears its head again, meaning your corrective action was not acceptable. Or anytime there's a risk of suspect or nonconforming product getting to the customer. Iman is asking, what do you mean by inspection adds cost and not value? Okay, so in adding a layer of inspection, it simply adds cost. So for example, when I mentioned we were mixing left-hand parts and right-hand boxes and vice versa, we had to hire a third-party containment part company to sort through all of those boxes to make sure only left-hand parts were in left-hand boxes. That cost a lot of money and it adds no value. We needed to identify the root cause so that it was impossible to put left-hand parts in right-hand boxes, and we didn't need that costly added layer of inspection. So Kip is asking a really interesting question that tends to come up a lot. Why is a nonconformity issued for one issue when it is determined not a systemic issue? Well, Kip, our auditor doesn't know if it's a systemic issue or not. What they find is one instance of a nonconforming gauge or a training record not updated or somebody using the wrong revision level of a document. One instance is enough to prompt a nonconformity. It's your job to do the look across and see the depth and breadth of the issue and determine how significant it is. That's why we write it up. Tom, I may need some help with your question. If there was a human error turning a PO, which I'm assuming is a purchase order, to a SO, not really sure what is an SO. What more than training can you do? If you want to clarify your question, I'd be happy to address it. Ray's asking, why is human error or oversight not acceptable? People make mistakes. You can't develop safeguards against every possible scenario. Human error or oversight do happen. I can't argue that, Ray. What you need to do as an organization is understand where a lot of these mistakes are happening and implement safeguards in your system to prevent their occurrence. So adding error proofing into your processes. And if error proofing is cost prohibitive, what you may need to do is add extra layers of inspection to minimize those errors that are being made. But error proofing, pokey yolk, is always the first option. Max is asking a great question. What happens if the scope of an issue is so large that the remedy for the problem takes multiple years and could overlap multiple surveillance audits? We do see that sometimes, Max, where the only acceptable corrective action would be maybe implementation of a new ERP system or a new training software program or adding an addition to a building. And we have to manage those through our surveillance audits and make sure that you're making progress on your corrective action throughout the year or years. Where you may run into an issue with this is if it happens on a registration or recertification audit, where we can't issue a certificate until the issue's closed. Rebecca's asking, is it acceptable to continue with the extra inspection when management considers the actual correction, I think you mean corrective action, would cost too much in comparison to the cost of the part? Just remember that extra inspection is a correction, not a corrective action. So you would still need a corrective action to address your root cause. And perhaps it's not a costly error proofing, but it might be something else, Rebecca. Iman is asking if there's a certain period to finish a corrective action. No, you might have to meet some customer requirements, Iman. But the ISO standards only prescribe, for example, when you need a corrective action response in. And sometimes majors have to be closed within a certain period of time. Douglas raises a good point that even 100% inspection is not always 100%. He cites that four people must each perform 100% inspection to statistically reach close to 100, which could be cost prohibitive. Yeah, that's exactly my point, Douglas. A costly added layer of inspection, once you determine the true root cause and corrective action, that costly added inspection should be removed. So Tom's asking, has clarified human error turning a PO to a sales order. What more than training can you do? Yet chances are you've already trained Tom. You state the wrong part was typed into the sales order. It wasn't caught on our two-person check. I don't know if some revision to the software itself is possible, where maybe certain values auto-populate. I don't know. I've answered all the questions that have come in. I will try to answer them in the 4 minutes remaining. Okay, Edward looks like he's making a statement. If the root cause points to a third-party processor, the root cause could be the third-party system is not completely effective. Okay, I'm not sure what your question is, Edward. Iman's asking, could you please share with us a real case study for root cause and corrective action used? Iman, keep an example that I've provided two examples in today's training and provided an anecdote about a real life example in the manufacturing world. So if you want those in writing, you can download a copy of the slides. Interesting question from Max. You have a shareable example of an issue where a certification has been revoked. We're in the unfortunate position of having to revoke certificates. So let's talk what revocation means. Revocation is the same as a certificate withdrawal, which is a punitive action. A certificate cancellation is a voluntary request from the client to cancel their certificate. They've decided they don't want to maintain the management system certification. A withdrawal or revocation is always started with a certificate suspension, Max. So it doesn't just happen overnight. There'll be a suspension or a warning first. Very limited instances where that suspension doesn't happen. Common reasons are when a client doesn't effectively address corrective actions in the appropriate time period, client doesn't pay money owed, or client could executes what's known as a prohibited act, where they falsify information. R2, for example, the R2v3 standard outlines a number of prohibited acts that can lead to automatic suspension. But a very common reason is not addressing corrective actions promptly. Another common reason certificates might get suspended and then eventually withdrawn by a certification body is because a client doesn't schedule their audit. Okay, we've got one more minute. Edward has clarified his question. Our supplier sent non-conforming parts. These parts affected our product. Edward, I trust that you would send that supplier a SCAR, and they would determine what the root cause is, and then that in turn would be communicated to your customer. You can't communicate to your customer without first interfacing and getting feedback and input from your supplier. Okay, folks, we're out of time for today. Appreciate your attention, and I hope you found this webinar helpful. And we look forward to seeing you on future webinars. Check out pjr.com for exciting content coming in the new year.